All right, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am Karen Sloat, and I've been a member of the Four Seas for 27 years since I married my husband, Stephen Sloat, and very pleased to provide this seminar, finally. I am a lawyer in Indian Wells, California, which is about 2 hours northeast of here. My practice is focused on employment law and representation of nonprofits and contracts. So this is right up my alley. What we're doing today is discussing the best governing documents. We're going to discuss some policies. We're going to discuss some war stories. And especially, I want to give you warnings. I want to give you an overview of what every ministry should have in place at this time in our century. And warnings about what might be coming to your church, even to a little church or big church, that will challenge your documents, your policies, your beliefs. And what I want to make sure that I say right up front is I don't practice in 50 states. I practice in California. I've practiced in Colorado and Hawaii. I'm not providing legal advice today, except to give you some general thoughts to go back to your attorneys in your states to get the state law that applies to your particular ministries. So do I have anyone here who is not a pastor? How many pastors do we have here? Okay.
Wow.
Anyone else on a board, a board of directors, board of trustees, nonprofit board? Okay. Anyone?
We have another attorney here too.
Oh, great. Great. Nice to meet you. So we have an attorney. We have other lay members of churches? Okay. Great. Great. Some of this discussion today will be focused on a church or a ministry as a corporation. Some will focus on the church as an employer or as a ministry that's not a corporation. But also, even if you're a member of a board of directors or involved in a church, a ministry, which is a nonprofit, these are good tips to pass on to the leaders. These are geared at the leaders to get things going if they haven't already. Where's my tech guy? There it is. Phew. All right. So most leaders of nonprofits I have found are not prepared. How many of you who are involved in a leadership role have been through an orientation? That is an orientation of your board or your leaders? Nobody. Has anybody had corporate governance training? So you know what corporate documents are required. Great. One. I recommend for all leaders, and if you're not a leader, to tell the leaders to go through a process where you tell your leaders what I'm going to tell you today, figure out what they need to know, and figure out whether your documents are in place. The purpose of board orientation is obviously to train leaders, because many people just think, hey, we can get together, we'll form a ministry, we'll do the things for the Lord, we'll share the gospel, and don't get organized properly. And then if you have a challenge down the road, you're not going to be prepared. You won't have the governing documents on file. Also, do you ever think about the strategic mission of your association or your corporation? Many don't. They just say, well, day to day, we're doing the ministry of the Lord. But I'm going to ask you to think about strategy. Have you ever heard of fiduciary duties of a board of directors or an officer of a corporation? Fiduciary duties are the duties of a leader that requires the leader put the organization's interests over the individual's interests. We're going to develop some efficient policies and talk about how the leaders, the governance, and the strategic direction all work together. So again, if you're part of a board, if you're part of a leadership group, even a board of elders, these are the types of things that seem obvious to those of us who are responsible. You should require your board members to show up and to prepare, to know the agendas, to study the issues, to read the documents. And especially, you'll note the second to the last one, is treat everything as confidential. What happens in the room as you discuss as a board or a group stays in the room unless there's authority or a consensus to pass that on. Be respectful of people and ideas. We experience a lot of conflicts within boards that lead to the dissolution of the corporation or the company. All right, so other expectations of board members, and again, part of this is kind of dry, but and may be very obvious to you, but you should be able to talk about your mission. How many of you know the mission statement of your church? Okay, most. If you're on a nonprofit or in some other organization in the community, anybody? Another nonprofit? Do you know the mission statement of the nonprofit? Okay. Most board members don't, at least in my experience. They come to the meetings, they show up, they want to talk about stuff, but they leave. Strongly recommend that you know the mission statement, you recruit future leaders, you recruit young members, and then communicate when you need assistance. Under the laws of California, which is what I'll speak about today, corporate laws, the corporation's code, requires that there be certain officers of a corporation. So how many of your churches are nonprofit corporations? Okay, a bunch. Good. Let me speak about that for a moment then. Often trustees are the same as directors under the law, but the law requires directors and officers. Do you know who your president is? You may have a chair of the board of elders. Is that also the president? Is the pastor the president? You'll need a president and at least a treasurer secretary. There are supposed to be two distinct persons. There can be one director of a nonprofit corporation, but there must be at least two officers. So even if you're not a director, you need to have a second person who's the secretary treasurer, at least under the state of California Corporations Code, which is very common. What do officers do? Do you know what a president does? A secretary, a vice president, a treasurer, a CFO, whatever they're called, executive officers. Anybody know what an executive committee is? Tell me what an executive committee is.
A smallest portion of the board in power to make decisions on behalf of the board.
Great. And who's typically on an executive committee?
President, vice president, treasurer, and secretary.
See, you got Steve Felker here. You don't even need me. All right. How about committees and volunteers? Do you use committees? All right. So sometimes you'll need a special work session if you don't know exactly what the vice president is supposed to do or what the secretary does. What the executive committee does, you may need a session on what their duties are. People may assume what a secretary does or a treasurer. Ask prospective leaders, that's pretty obvious. Committees may be a source of future leaders. All right, so there are three duties of a nonprofit corporation board member. Duty of care, loyalty, and obedience. You can read them right there. Many directors don't know that they have these fiduciary duties. They have legal duties to the organization that override their individual interests. So, for example, I see typically some guy will own a construction company. He'll sit on a board of a church or some other nonprofit and offer that his construction company can come in and do a remodel job. Any problem with that? Conflict of interest, right. So, naive boards are going to say, sure, come on in, bring your workers in, we'll have you do all the work, and oh, we'll just pay you cash, it's no problem. Tons of red flags. The obedience, the loyalty has to be to the organization first. So again, on the dry stuff, very briefly, do you have a mission statement? Is it written? Do you have articles of incorporation and bylaws? How many people can tell me where their bylaws are located? Okay, that's good, that's pretty good, that's over half, that's great. Have your bylaws been amended recently? He was nodding, sure. They may need amendment, and I'm going to talk about that later. Policy manual. Do any of you have employees? Do you have an employment manual? Employee handbook. Is it up to date? Do you know that the laws have changed dramatically in the last 2 years? Strategic plan. Again, it may not apply to too many churches. It may apply to ministries. Financial statement. Does everyone have a budget in your organization? Good. Do you stick to it? Okay. We'll talk about minutes in a few minutes and these other things. So the mission statement, most of you raised your hands. You do have a mission statement. It's very important. Memorize the mission statement. Have an elevator speech. Be able to tell people on the street, hey, you know what our church stands for? This, this, and this. Or our parachurch ministry stands for this and this. This is what we're doing to reach the lost. These the specialists that I'm going to talk about a little bit today, Michael Batts, did board member orientation. It's a book that I found very clear and easy to read. called Board Member Orientation. Michael Batt's available on Amazon, about $14 to $17. He says that it's very important to publicize your mission statement. Do you have it on a banner? Do you have it on posters when you have events? Do you have it on your minutes? Do you have it on your bulletin at church? If you want to grow, that's the way to do it. All right, so the Articles of Incorporation. How many people know where their Articles of Incorporation are? How many Articles of Incorporation are before 1960? Established before 1960? Okay. You may want to amend them. Some of those early Articles of Incorporation had the list of the directors that made all the decisions in 1946 or whatever, and those people are still the only ones authorized under some old articles to make the decisions, and they're long gone. Not-for-profit corporation is the same thing as a non-profit corporation, or as my husband says, couldn't be for profit.
Church, yeah.
Yes. How many organizations are exempt under IRS 501c3, Internal Revenue Code? Okay, so just a note on that. I think it's very important to be 501c3 if you're not. In California, you can file a religious association. You can get a mutual public benefit corporation status. You can get all kinds of recognition by the state that does not involve falling under the Internal Revenue Code under the 501c3 status. With the ways that the IRS has attacked nonprofits, certain conservative groups, and the way that I'm going to talk later about the ways we are losing our religious rights, I strongly recommend that you go through the process now while it's still feasible to get the 501c3 and get classified on a federal level as opposed to just the state level. You must have a dissolution clause. The dissolution clause provides that when you fold, if you fold, your assets go to another 501c3 organization. Please, if you forget, if you remember anything else, go back to your articles and your bylaws. Pull them out. Make sure they have a dissolution clause. It's one you agree to. Our church, I'm going to use our church as an example, had one that left all the money to the Disciples of Christ. Well, the church hadn't been a member of Disciples of Christ for a long time. Many nonprofits have funny little dissolution clause that leave it to this group of people who are going to start this particular type of ministry to the, let's say, the Somalian people. Well, that was from 40 years ago. May not apply, and you're still bound by that dissolution clause today. All right.
Is there time later?
Either way, go ahead. Do you have a question about
our dissolution clause? The way our church words it, it's something to the effect that if the church dissolves, whatever will be left to a nonprofit association agreed upon by the congregation at that time.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no specific group or mission, it's just upon the vote of the remaining members.
Sometimes that'll work. Let me give you a scenario when that won't work. If the remaining members are a rebel group and they've chased out all, let's say, the Bible-believing Christians, and they decide they want to give it to a 501c3, and that's all it says, any other 501c3 organization, they can give it to the Animal Samaritans. They can give it to the Jewish Federation. Unless it says the 501c3...
LGBT,
sure. 501c3 that pursues the gospel of Jesus Christ or is similar in kind to, you know, our church or some kind of direction, it could be left to a rogue group at the end. That's my biggest tip on that one. The 4C used to have, and I don't know if they have it anymore, a bylaw constitutional kit where you could go through a bunch of questions about your particular church.
It's down at the book table. It's just come out in a new version.
Great.
That.
Thank you, Gary.
Yeah.
Okay, I couldn't find it online. It used to be online. You could purchase it,
oh, really?
As I recall, or at least members could get to it. So if you need guidance on creating bylaws, getting bylaws up to date, that's one avenue. Very briefly, I know this is a little dry. We'll go through a board agenda. Do you know how to prepare a board agenda? Do you know what to do with it? Typically, it's ideally it's prepared 2 weeks in advance. Some of them I get a day before. but communicate with the leaders in your group about the agenda. Does it have the right items on it? What are the current issues? Have you talked with everybody to make sure there's no crisis? Meeting minutes process, again, very quickly. Whoever keeps the minutes should follow these directions. And I don't think people know how to keep minutes. I get questions all the time. How detailed should they be? Use your agenda as a guideline. Try to keep the minutes according to the agenda. Seems very simple. Most people don't do it. Recording what should be included, the date and time of the meeting, every person who was there. It's critical to put down who was there, who left early, who came in late, what happened. It doesn't have to be in great detail. Sometimes you don't want to take down every comment that everybody said because they can be very damaging later. Those minutes are discoverable in litigation. So if the corporation, even if the church is involved in litigation, depending on the issue, a court may be able to, or an arbitrator may be able to demand production of those minutes. And if they say, well, Steve Felker said, that this guy was an idiot, you've got it right in there. It's defamation. Truth is a defense, Steve. Truth is a defense. All right. Decisions about, this is again in the handout that I can provide you by email. There's a sheet going around, by the way, for those who came in late to sign up by email if you'd like this PowerPoint. Be objective in writing the minutes. That's something that people don't think about, and they're emotional. Well, there was an argument between, John and Sue about such and such. Don't be personal. Keep it to the facts. All right. Distributing and filing the minutes. Minutes need to be distributed. Everybody needs to get them. I get minutes the day before the next meeting for a certain board I'm on, and all the action items are moot because nobody did it in the last month. So distribute your minutes. Seems very obvious, but all right. So the governing body of your organization establishes the policy and may establish exactly what the day-to-day operations are by either the lead pastor, an executive director, or CEO of a nonprofit. To establish board policies, it's a good idea to do that in writing so that the policies dribble down into action items for your leaders. And then for the staff, if there is a staff. Oh, my husband's yawning. Okay, I'm going faster.
No.
Employment policies.
No sleep.
I know, you got no sleep. General employment policies. My bread and butter is making handbooks for employers, all kinds. Medical practices, restaurants, nonprofit organizations, huge, tiny, everybody. These are the ones I've pulled out that I use in my nonprofit corporation handbooks. If you have any questions about these, I'm happy to answer them. But they're just good policies that most people either don't write down or don't think about. The internet, the email, the electronic usage, the software is critical these days. I have a lot of lawsuits involving nonprofits, claims involving nonprofits as well as for-profits, where someone wrote a bunch of emails back and forth, and those emails have become the basis for a harassment, discrimination, defamation lawsuit. The texting that goes back and forth, I'll talk about that tomorrow a little bit, but texting we assume is safe, and texting between friends turns into discrimination based upon gender, all kinds of harassment. I have one case between a gay man and a straight man right now, and they consensually engaged in lots of texting, and now of course the straight man has moved on and is suing the company for those texts. Software usage, get permission to load your software. These kinds of things, dress code, performance evaluations, employee records, all should be in writing. If you don't have a handbook, please find someone locally to get you a handbook. Very, very important. Please address timekeeping and pay in your handbooks. Lots of nonprofits have paid the old-fashioned way. They either pay by check, they don't run everything through payroll, everybody's salaried. Just a moment on this, but most of my practice is wage and hour litigation, and it doesn't matter if you're a church. If you're not paying people the right minimum wage plus overtime, you're not keeping your time records perfectly with meal breaks in and out, and salaried people are only managerial, administrative, executive, you could be sued. You could be sued and dragged through either the labor commissioner of your state or litigation, and the penalties in our state are extremely high for not just doing timekeeping properly. Christian dispute resolution, I'm going to provide you, if you sign up on the email sheet, I'm going to provide you with a Christian dispute resolution policy. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but I want you all to have that if possible. Here's some other ones, anti-harassment policy. I'm going to go into that tomorrow. The just basic is that the state laws governing secular employers are different from Title VII, which governs all the nation's religious employers. There's usually a religious exemption relating to harassment and retaliation and discrimination for religious entities. There's also, I mentioned at the bottom of that slide, a lifestyle policy. I'm providing a sample to you of a lifestyle policy which requires that all employees and volunteers sign that they will maintain a biblical lifestyle. All right, and then you put those policies and procedures into your activities, into your events. Make sure that even volunteers and independent contractors know what your policies are and your statement of faith, and know the financial protocols. All right, contracts. How many of you have a contract, some contract with somebody for your ministry? Okay, great. Have you had it reviewed by a lawyer? Okay. They can be as innocent as a copy machine contract. Brief war story, copy machine contracts for leasing copy machines. Seems like you have no choice, right? You just sign the dot and bottom line, don't have to read it. They never let you out of that lease contract. You can try to turn the copier back in. You can send that copier back in after 5 years. You're still guaranteed for as long as they have in that lease to pay that thousands of dollars a year. And I have had churches and nonprofits get in trouble because they just sign contracts with vendors and don't even have anyone review them. Contracts with independent contractors, let's talk about that for a moment. The guys who come and want to help out with your gardening and they want to help out with some construction and a little painting, how do you pay them? Just call out, you have to call it hypothetical. How do you pay those people?
Write a check as if, you know, on submission of a bill.
And maybe cash? And maybe volunteer? Do they have workers' compensation? Do they have general liability policies? Do they have a written contract that ensures that you're not the employer of their workers?
Business license.
Business license, right.
That's what the guy providing the service is supposed to have.
They are. And if they don't have it, you need a contract in place. The church or the ministry should have a contract in place that says, yes, you, John Smith, can come do work for us, but you promise you have, you know, business license, insurance, your workers are covered by workers' compensation, we are not responsible as a dual employer, etc. So all those things can lead to ministry liability. It doesn't matter if you're a religious organization. All right, let's talk about the hot, interesting stuff. Potential challenges for leasing out a church facility. We just talked about that as we were walking in. Including personal injuries, that's the easy one. Do you have insurance for personal injuries on your premises? That's usually general liability insurance. Or if you have volunteer workers coming onto your premises, some of the volunteers and the contractors may be covered by your workers' comp insurance. Don't be lulled into thinking that your pastors, your secretaries, the few others in your tiny little church don't have to be covered by workers' comp. You have to get all employees covered by workers' comp. And if you have volunteers coming on, They may be covered by workers' comp.
We use Church Mutual, and they have four volunteers, like on a work day. They're not just covered for injuries. We have workers' comp for them. It's very low cost through Church Mutual. So if they got injured, they would just, if they were permanently injured, they're covered through workers' comp.
I had one horror story that where a guy was remodeling his pool in Palm Springs. He hired a contractor. He had a contractor's written agreement with this general contractor to remodel his pool. The guy brings in workers who were not lawfully allowed to work in the United States. The workers came on site. A neighbor saw this construction going on. Neighbor reported it to the labor commissioner. The labor commissioner coordinated with our contractor state license board and the employment development department and a compliance officer, and they all four drove to the house. These Latino guys went running, and it turned out that the homeowner was going to be held responsible for all the wage problems and all the injuries on site and for not getting a proper city license for remodeling his pool. The general contractor was unlicensed, so the homeowner was held responsible and sued at the same time as the general contractor. General contractor lost his license. just for a pool. So.
New York State's similar.
Sorry?
New York State's gavel law is similar. If somebody's injured on a job site and they're a subcontract to the general contractor who signed the contract, they are not under his contract.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a general contractor working in my house, he brings an electrician, this guy is maybe uninsured, whatever else, this guy falls off the step ladder, scaffold law says he can sue the homeowner.
Right.
And most homeowner policies don't cover that situation.
Right. Some of them have a workman rider that covers workman on your site.
Yeah, you have to put the right riders in for work being done, so.
And an example, again, in our church, for years and years, they just paid the nursery caretaker and she was also the janitor, and paid him a salary, paid him a flat fee every week for years. And then she turned out she was bringing her nephew on site. He was doing half the work. Whose employee is he? The church. Yeah, she and this nephew were the employees of the church. If there had been any challenge, because he's coming on site with the church's knowledge that he's doing work, if he injured himself, has to be covered by workers' comp and go through payroll. All right, so how can a church ministry protect itself when others want to use the facility? Same-sex marriage, right? Same-sex parties. Well, if you're a cake baker, you know that you can't refuse a cake. I've put in the best governing documents a sample facilities use policy. Maybe that's the next slide. Facilities use policy. There are certain ways to do a facilities use policy. So this is a takeaway, as I say. The one I have provided in the sample is one that says no one may use our facility unless they comply with our statement of faith. It's very strict. Then you're protected and you have a document that allows you to say we don't do same-sex marriages here and we won't allow this type of party, LGBTQ party or whatever. It allows you to turn away certain public uses of your religious facility. I will tell you that our church ran into a snag as soon as I drafted this, because now we've connected with a charter school that wants to use our church facilities. It's fantastic. All the kids will come in. All the families will come in. We'll build our ministry.
Run by Christians.
It's run by Christians, but it's a public charter school. Mm-hmm. So they can't sign our facilities use policy that says, we agree with your statement of faith, your doctrine. What they can do is say, we will teach nothing that is contrary to. However, in California, all schools are now required down to kindergarten to teach about transgender, bisexual, etc., which we'll be talking about tomorrow. They are required to, and they may be required to provide bathroom facilities for other gender, transgender. That's all shake-up.
The other piece in that is you may make a statement of faith, whatever, but you need to have something to teach that actually plainly and clearly says what your marriage positions are. So
exactly.
I was doing the Constitution for the Four Seasons, I was also doing one for our church because I'm a glutton for punishment. and we included in there that all uses of the facility will be in keeping with Christ Chapel's statement of faith and positions of conscience. But if we don't have a position of conscience paper on marriage and sexuality, that's a useless thing to have in our Constitution. So you also need to have that other piece.
That's right.
Says, you don't have to roll necessarily in your constitution, but you need to have something formal.
Right, and I'm going to recommend that it get into your constitution. If you're that firm on that position, get it into your constitution, have a position paper, we'll be talking about position paper in a minute, and then have these contracts, like a facility use policy that reiterates that. Is your statement of faith passed out to all of your employees? Is it passed out to your congregants, your parishioners? Do people know it's around? Because if it's in the back drawer of some filing cabinet, I guarantee you're not going to convince some challenge, in some court that you are doing everything according to that statement of faith.
I have a quick question about that. Is there some distinction between the terms sex and gender? Like if you have a policy that says no same gender marriages versus same sex marriages, is there a preference in wording?
Good question. There is not. The discrimination laws cover either gender or sex, and they're interchangeable. Typically, I believe Title VII says sex, which is the federal law. Gender is used in our state of California statutes. All right, be ready for calls and inquiries. Here's my first media contacts. Here's my first war story. Let me go back. When Prop 8 was going through California, the telephone rang right after our church service. I happened to be walking by putting praise music away. No one else was around, but anybody could have been around. A church secretary, an elder, anybody.
Just parishioner.
Any parishioner. Answer the phone, hello, Coachella Valley Christian Church. Hi, does the pastor do marriages of same-sex couples? Oh, well, he does weddings. Will he marry a same-sex couple? Well, I'll tell you what, I'll let you talk to the pastor. No, I want to know if he does same-sex. Tell you what, you talk to the pastor. The pastor requires some counseling. He has certain procedures you go through. Let me put you on hold. Quick, I got him on hold. If I can tell you, if any of our elders had answered, they would have said, heck no! It could have been a disaster. But they were calling, prompting us, testing us to get something into the media. I quickly got Stephen away from all the prisoners, got him on the phone. This guy said he was in a hospital. His partner was there. They wanted to be married right away, I think because he was dying.
Yes.
And Stephen fortunately knew what to say and said, tell you what, I'd be happy to talk with you about it. I'll come over to the hospital right now. What room are you in? I think he gave you a room.
There's nobody there.
Yeah, hung up. It was a total false call. There's no one at the hospital with that name. It was just to bait us. And we're a little church. That's why I want one of the warnings to you today. They're going to call it the little church because the little church isn't aware and ready. And someone's going to say, no, we don't do same-sex marriage. We can't, no, that's not in our church polity or whatever. And you're going to be the subject of a media blast.
And maybe law. And not every church has a pastor's wife who's a lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, even the secretaries would have said something to get us in trouble. All right, so strategic planning, we've talked about that a little bit. Depends on if you're in a ministry, in a parachurch ministry, I can see this with a church. I think it's probably pretty hard to do strategic planning and plan on meeting, you know, getting 15 members in 3 years. But it's just you. Financial controls. I'll talk about that. We'll go to war stories pretty quickly. Michael Batts talks in his book about financial controls, but you can also find resources on the internet. It is very important with your fiduciary duties to the organization or the entity to have checks and balances. Does anybody actually check the backup receipts to the checks that are written to the parishioners or to the vendors? Is anybody doing that minutia? Because if you're not, you won't. There's so much embezzlement that goes on. There's so much misuse of church funds and ministry funds. And people don't find out for years until it's up to $30,000, $50,000, $100,000. Compare the budget. Use your budget. Lots of entities create a budget and it goes into a drawer, or we talk about it in a year. Use your budget. Figure out whether your expenses are meeting the budget. A W-9, kind of what Steve was talking about. If someone comes to you and says, I want to do some work on the premises, the W-9 form is the IRS form that allows you to get their Social Security number or their FEIN, their Federal Employer ID number. You pay that person based upon that FEIN, that number that identifies them, and then you issue a 1099 to that person for doing the work. That's a contractor work on the premises. You can try to withhold payment if they won't give you a W-9, or find another contractor. Because again, if they don't provide you with that W-9 and the other proper paperwork, you become their employer. You could be their employer for all purposes. All right, we talked about budget. Financial audit. How many of your entities have an audit or a review? Good. Handful. So whether you have a CPA do a full audit, which is very expensive, or a CPA firm do a review, it's prudent, and have good communication, open communication with your auditors if you have claims. Have two people in every transaction is a good financial control. I'm going to pop ahead here. Do you have a provision in your documents that says volunteers are immune from suit? In our state, there's a nice indemnity provision that's permitted in bylaws and articles, if desired, that says that anyone volunteering for the organization is immune from suit, provided that they are acting in the course and scope of their service to the church or to the nonprofit. If a volunteer acts ultra vires or outside the scope of their service, for example, commits defamation, then that person could be individually liable. Get those in place. All right. Insurance. I hope you all have insurance. I'm going to mention sex abuse, the top five reasons that churches end up in court. Consistently, sexual abuse of a minor. Do you have written policies in place for the nursery, for the child care? Do you have two adults who have background checks who are in your nursery? If that's not possible, do you have one person at least with a background check? Do you know that, in at least in California, there are three separate forms that have to be filled out before a background check is permitted? A background check policy, we at the church do this kind of background check, a background check authorization where the person signs, I agree that my background can be checked, and then a form that also authorizes the background check and a report being given to that person whose background is checked through the Bureau of Investigation, FBI or CBI in our case. Do you do all that? It's a good idea. All right, some more stories. So very briefly, what boards or ministry leaders need to be aware of is that the government may try to take advantage of you. We had a situation in our church where the government came and said, we need some easement land. We need to take some easement for a public utility.
The utility came. It wasn't specifically.
It's a district of the state. And they said, we need to take this land from you, church, and we're going to pay you $1,500. Fortunately, they contacted me. I looked into the property value of that land, and it turned out to be closer to $45,000. And then by the time we added in our negotiating fees, it turned into $90,000. So they were going to slip this little $1,500 at the church and take all this land, and then they messed up, put the utilities in the wrong place, messed up our parking lot. Again, we had to fight over like a year and a half. We got them to replace our parking lot. If a utility comes in or the government comes in and says, we're taking your land, a red flag should go up. Don't try to do it alone. We have a friend right now who has a church in Anaheim. Won't mention the name. And a few years ago, the government came in and said, we're building a street. We need to take off the corner of your property. And they didn't know any better. And they said, okay. And there went a corner of their property.
No compensation.
Zero. That same governmental entity, the city, has come back and said, okay, now we're going to take 20 feet off the entire corner of your property. They're going to wipe out 100 trees that are 40 years old. They're going to wipe out their wedding and events area. And they were not offering a penny. Fortunately, they contacted me, thanks to Stephen mentioning it. And now we've written them along 3 pages of conditions of approval that will require them to compensate the church for that lost land and for the lost weddings and for any damage that occurs, and to restore the premises and restore the sign. So contact an attorney if anybody comes and tries to take your land. There was a church here in San Diego County where a bird, we don't remember what kind of bird, but a certain bird who's on the endangered species list was inhabiting a nest on a huge part of the church property, a huge hill. The environmental people came in and said, you can't do anything on that hill. You must dedicate that hill to environmental protection, to the migration plan that's approved for your area. And the church fought it. The church spent $1 million over 5 years in litigation. It was in the news.
Yeah.
And they lost. And the bird had long flown away. The bird wasn't even living there anymore for the last 2 years. But the battle was intense. Right now I'm dealing with another environmental attack on a golf course. If a species plan is put into place in your area, that means the government has said these endangered species are protected over the human's use of that land. And from talking with environmental experts, I now have learned you will pay money if you don't want to give your land away. You'll have to pay for some other place for the bighorn sheep or the whatever geese. Litigation is almost a total failure. One more story about this. T-Mobile came into our church, sent something into the secretary and said, oh, would you just sign this little agreement? Fortunately, they got my review of the cell tower agreement, and we got some money per month for the cell tower. Well, then they realized they'd made a mistake on it, and they slipped an amendment to the secretary. Oh, you know, Beverly, just sign this. We found a typo. Would you sign this and send it back in? Fortunately, she sent it to me. It turned out that they had built the structure in a wider area than was planned, and they owed us thousands and thousands of dollars. Again, you'll have to train your staff, you'll have to train your parishioners. If there's anything that comes in, get it reviewed by somebody who knows what they're doing, and it may not be an elder. You may have to hire an attorney for a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars. It will be well worth it. Don't be taken advantage of. All right, let's talk about same-sex equality, or whatever you want to call it. In June, SB 1146 was just passed in California, requiring that all Christian education institutions that receive federal funding must teach on transgender and bisexual issues. It's coming up for vote August 5. This is for Christian schools. BIOLA would be required, because it gets federal funding, to teach on same-sex issues. I'll be talking tomorrow about discrimination laws, but California just passed a law on March 28, which became effective April 1st, which required that all employers in the state describe in written policies posted on the wall what is a bisexual, what is transgender, what is same-sex, and all the protections. All these people are protected, and you can't say anything against them, and you're guilty of discrimination, harassment, let me say liable for discrimination, retaliation, and harassment, unless you post all this, put it into your written policies immediately by April 1st. ChristianMingle.com. Anybody ever heard of ChristianMingle.com? What do you think it's designed to do?
Dating site.
Dating site for?
Christians.
For Christians, right? Right? Christian Mingle has always had an application form that allows you to put in whether you're a male or female seeking the opposite gender. Well, two gentlemen filed a lawsuit because they couldn't sign up to match with another male. Lawsuit ensued, $450,000 later in attorney fees for the plaintiff. The judge decided, and this was a... I believe it's nationwide. Sparks Networks, this is the Supreme Court of the State of California, has ruled that the gentleman had the right to sign up for the same-sex partner, even on Christian Mingle, even on Seventh-day Adventist Mingle, and Jewish Mingle, and a whole host of others, because the Sparks entity that formed all these Mingle corporations had not signed up and not formed the paperwork for a religious nonprofit. Christian Mingle is not a religious nonprofit. It's just an entity. Didn't put any religious protections into that particular angle. And the men got $9,000. And Christian Mingle now not only has to change all of their application forms to give the option of selecting a same-sex partner, but has to check in periodically with the plaintiff's attorneys. And if they are not in compliance, they have to pay more money or go back to court.
How much was the
$9,000 to the plaintiffs, and then they had to pay $450,000 to the plaintiff's attorneys. All right, 3 miles from our house, the Church of Southwest. It used to be Southwest Community Church, I think.
It is Southwest Community.
Okay.
EV-free. EV-free
church. We're pretty much parallel with EV-free. Well, Pastor Gerald Sharon determined that despite a position paper on human sexuality and homosexuality that the elders had put in place many years before, he would not agree to it anymore, and he asked the elders to please get rid of the position paper, denounce it, because it was not friendly toward homosexuals who would want to come to the church. He thought it should be changed so that they'd feel more comfortable. And the elders said if that's not what we will permit, we're going to stick by our position paper. Pastor Sharon said he would not preach on that topic, and therefore the elders terminated his employment immediately. They were protesting at the church. There were parishioners who were quoted over and over in the media. We feel betrayed by the elders. It made front and page news, and it now has made national news. I have several articles because the pastor did not stick with the position paper. Be careful what you say. Please train your parishioners, train your other leaders. If any comments are made outside the scope of the church doctrine or not consistent with the church's position, they may lead to personal liability for libel or slander. When you counsel your other leaders, make sure that everyone knows they can speak when they are authorized to do so. Otherwise, if Joe Schmo goes out and says the church on the corner said this and this and this about homosexuality, that they have apparent authority. Train them to say, I can speak for the board, but I can only offer my personal opinion without board authority. Very quickly, another dry subject, but Form 990. How many of you file a Form 990? Okay, three hands. All nonprofits should be filing an IRS Form 990 to preserve your nonprofit exemption. So you need state nonprofit exemption, state tax exemption, and federal tax exemption. Okay? 990 requires that all board members review that form before it's filed with the Internal Revenue Service. If you haven't reviewed it, that means something's wrong in your procedures. Yep.
We just finished our
501c3.
Yeah. It was supposed to be done years ago, and our bookkeeper didn't do it. So it's pretty fresh in my mind. I think ours says that we're exempt from having to do that.
That's a 501c3?
The IRS agent put right in there that we don't have to do the annual. My Rotary Club has to do it every year, which we didn't, and we got us in trouble.
Yeah, I think ours too, for religious organizations.
I think for churches, they may exempt that.
Okay. For my other boards, for Form 990s, we are all supposed to review them, and we don't.
I think I just took that out of here.
I trust you.
If you fail 3 years in a row, you're tax status.
Right. Okay, sorry, I don't need to. All right, if you file a Form 990, make sure that you have a conflict of interest policy. How many of you have a written conflict of interest policy? One. Okay, get a conflict of interest policy, which
we
basically says if you have a potential financial interest or other interest that conflicts with the entity, the organization, the church, it needs to be disclosed, you need to be recused yourself, be excluded from voting. In certain nonprofits, you need to disclose that to the state in which you're located. All right. Policies on whistleblowing, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Anyone ever heard of Sarbanes-Oxley? No? Okay. Sarbanes-Oxley governs nonprofits in two respects, whistleblowing and record retention. You cannot retaliate against a whistleblower. If someone reports your organization for not following the law, for doing something unlawful, you can't retaliate and terminate them or exclude them. That can lead to a personal cause of action by that whistleblower. You can pay damages, attorney fees, all kinds of things. Don't destroy, alter, or falsify documents. I've had clients tell me, well, how about if we white out that part? No whiting out. If it's bad, it's bad. Deal with it. Amend it. But anything that's the subject of a federal proceeding, you've got to keep in its original intact form. All right. What types of training, call out, what types of training does your church provide to you? And the silence was deafening. Okay.
We do cover the child safety stuff annually as part of our annual meeting.
That's great.
Remind people what's in our form, stuff like that.
How about CPR? Any regular CPR training?
No. We're pastors and firefighters, so they just assume that's covered.
Right, and we had a doctor on site, and he just died. But everyone said, oh, if there's a problem, Dr. Dave will get it. You know?
ER doctor at that.
Yeah. So, written policies and procedures, please have them in place. Child abuse awareness, you should have a process. How do kids get picked up from the nursery? How is the reporting? Is there an ability for your nursery attendant to text? Our nursery attendant can barely operate a phone, much less text the right people. You should have text, you know, fill in a form when you check in your kid in the nursery, fill in their medical allergies, emergency phone numbers and all of that. I'm not going to go into that. You can find some on the internet. Transportation, if you're ever taking youth group on a trip, please get a release and waiver form from their parents. Please work on it with a lawyer or someone else who's knowledgeable. How about harassment training? Anybody have any discrimination, harassment training? Okay. So every employer in the state of California with 50 or more employees must have training every 2 years for all managerial supervisory employees. And it must be 2 hours long. Bullying is now in California a defined term within the discrimination statutes. There are no cases in which someone's saying they have a hostile work environment because of bullying, but because it's defined, if you're being derogatory towards someone, it can certainly be actionable and goes along with abusive conduct. So train, talk about it. At least talk about it in your leadership meetings, in your deacon meetings, in your deaconess meetings. Talk about those issues. Christian dispute resolution. Who can tell me what that is? Not you. Gary, give it a try.
I'm assuming it, like the peacekeeper thing does, where you agree that you will resolve disputes out of the courts and with a mediator that is agreed to, and you will abide by that position.
Great. Good, close try. Yes. Peacemaker Ministries, the sample I'm going to provide you is from Peacemaker Ministries. It provides that there is Christian conciliation, so there's a conciliation that's a very specific method by them, or there's Christian mediation if the conciliation doesn't resolve the dispute. If that doesn't work, there are Christian arbitrators. The difference between mediation and arbitration is that a mediator will work on getting the parties to come up with a mutually agreeable resolution or solution, usually put in writing. An arbitrator makes the decision for you. So you can present your claims, your evidence, witnesses, and the arbitrator will make a decision that can be binding. If you don't have a Christian dispute resolution provision in your bylaws, in your even in some of your member covenants, in your employee contracts, at the end of your employee handbook, then, or even in vendor contracts, you could be going to court for every little dispute. Steve.
Yeah, are some of these things covered in the 4C's just fairly recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, put out a manual for bylaws. Is that included in that?
I believe that John and I did put that in, yes, actually. And it hasn't changed. I checked with Peacemaker, and there is the same basic provision. So I'll be handing that out, too, if you sign up on the sheet. But even small disputes, I represent a Christian school. It was just 2 employees determined they were discriminated against based upon their disability and their origin, which was Latino, and they both filed with the state immediately. We went back and we said, we have a Christian dispute resolution provision, and the attorney said, I don't care. I'm going forward to the state courts. I'm not going to stop. And it was a 6-month dispute just to enforce our statement. So it's critical that you have it in place. All right, so your turn. Shoot some questions at me. What's going on with your ministries and how can I help you? Steve.
I sit on a board of a Christian, it's called Share Care Prayer, and the founder died quite unexpectedly. All of the board members moved to a different part of the country and have basically gone silent. So the office was here in Southern California. All of her files, it was an unbelievable mess. But anyway, we moved all of her stuff out and put it in public storage. And I assumed that the chairman of the board was they wanted to dissolve the organization with the IRS. Well, nobody on the board wants anything to do with it. So I'm kind of sad because I'm the only one that lives near here. So all the papers are in public storage in Pasadena. And the only response I get from the chairman is, hey, I live in South Dakota. Deal with it. So I called IRS and I said, how do we dissolve an organ? Not how do we keep it going, but now how do we dissolve? I was just stunned. I mean, she basically told me on the phone, she said, you're going to have to go back, because we were getting all these letters that we have in file, not just 990, but all these other, for years, the founder just didn't do any paperwork. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like 10 years worth of missed stuff. And now IRS is saying, well, you have to go back and I think the term was somehow reestablish your standing with the IRS before you can even close it out. And I at that point, I just went, not my that. How in the world do you do this?
I had that happen to a little booster wrestling club for a high school. And they hadn't filed their forms in years, and they were being taxed. They got a notice from the Franchise Tax Board and from the IRS that they had to pay all these taxes based upon the income that they'd raised from fundraising efforts. And yes, we had to go back. We had to find a CPA to file every Form 990 and write letters and, sorry, and prove that we really have not engaged in for-profit activities in the last 5 or 6 years. I think it was 9 years. And so, we had to show bank accounts and everything.
So are all of us board members liable then for all of this in terms of, because the verbal, you know, from everybody is, hey, you deal with it because we don't live in California anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just out of, I mean, I just don't even want to think about it. But I have to.
I bet you don't, yeah.
I know, but eventually it's not going away, right?
Probably not. You'll probably get a tax bill. I mean, that's what has happened to my nonprofit. So I've got a bill in the mail from the Franchise Tax Board, $4,000 due for taxes. Because you run in, eventually when they catch up, you're going to go through their for-profit calculators. If your governing documents, if you can find them, say that you have volunteer immunity, you know, that volunteers are immune from suit, then personally you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
But as far as the organization, you have to convince somebody that you've been engaging in exempt activities these years. Maybe a bunch of letters will work as opposed to all the forms.
I hope so.
Get a CPA on your side.
Is there any financial resources?
Just her estate, that's the only thing that's going to be.
Gary.
We run into the, where's the line on renting your nonprofit church property?
Oh, okay, yes.
We have a church that leases from us, and we investing, but then other people have wanted to lease our kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to make food, but they're going to sell it for profit. Where are the lines?
Right. Uniform Business Income Tax, UBIT, it's called. The best thing to do is ask a CPA, and I'm not a CPA, I'm not a tax attorney, so I'm telling you this generally, because we just checked into it with a CPA for our particular firm, our particular church, and he does a lot of nonprofit work. There is no tax implication or loss of tax exemption for getting lease payments for leasing out your facilities. You don't lose your religious entity taxation exemption when you lease out your facilities, even if you get a bunch of money for leasing out those facilities. You also don't lose your religious exemption if you lease out to secular organizations.
Even if that organization is going to make money off of the activities on the property?
That's right.
Oh,
it's a simple lease payment to the church. You're allowed to lease out your facilities. Definitely have a lease agreement. Definitely have some kind of facility use agreement. Don't just let them pay cash, because then again, if they bring people on, they aren't properly licensed, you don't have a written contract, they could become your employees. Or volunteers that it could be injured on your premises and fall under your workers' comp, and the workers' comp carrier wasn't notified, and it gets messy. Tim.
Karen, in relation to that, I'm under the impression that if you're leasing or you're renting out your property for whatever reason, you should maintain records of what you're taking in for income, because if you turn a profit, in other words, if what you earn exceeds what it costs you to operate that building, utilities-wise and all that, it's no longer just a contribution to margin, it's a profit, and you have to report that as taxable income.
And you have to report all of it, yes. It is, that can be the UBIT problem,
okay.
You know, from business income tax.
Okay.
You can be taxed on that portion. And again, I'm not a tax expert, but there may be some tax implications as far as paying taxes. I haven't seen it happen before, but you don't lose your exemption.
Yeah. Follow-up question I have is regarding the bylaw revisions. I think you and I have had this discussion. I'm just wondering if there's any new information on it. Yeah, it really takes a lot of effort to get a 501c3 exemption. And in the process, you do have to submit a copy of your bylaws, your governing documents, and all of that. Some people would say that it's necessary every time you revise your bylaws or your constitution that you have to refile. Is that true?
Not that I know of, although the IRS recently rejected our 501c3 application because our bylaw dissolution clause did not match the old articles dissolution clause from 1958 or whatever it was. So they don't necessarily need an amendment, but if you're out of date when you follow up with some kind of refreshing of your 501c3, all your documents have to be in order.
What we had to do is redo the
articles in that corporation.
Right, to bring it up to what
to match, right. So the dissolution clause is matched.
Just the dissolution clause. But I mean, if you're just tweaking, you know, responsibilities of auditing, that kind of thing.
I have no knowledge of that. It needs to be reported to the IRS, unless it changes your religious characterization.
So if you put a statement on same-sex marriage in your bylaws, that doesn't have to, doesn't require you to be filed.
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. Not with the IRS, and you don't have to file bylaws with the state of California. I don't think you have to file bylaws with many states. Sometimes a bank will require your bylaws,
right.
Or their entities, but not the...
So the dissolution clause is key. Whatever you have in your articles of incorporation, for instance, if you publish your vision, purpose, and mission in your articles of incorporation, mm-hmm. then you better be sure that they match with your bylaws. If you're going to try to make an effort to change any of that, then you...
Yeah, I think articles and bylaws often don't match on vision, purpose, mission. It's the dissolution clause that must match to preserve the assets and preserve your tax exemption, because you have to give those the assets to a 501c3, or if you're not a corporation and you're not 501c3, you have to give it to another ministry with like purposes.
Thank you.
But in our state, the religious associations are recognized and still have religious protections, even if they're not a corporation. In my view, you should be a corporation. You should go through the process and get all the paperwork in place to protect your ministry formally by the state and the IRS.
Karen, I know a couple of churches in our area that have been working real hard on the same-sex issue wording for the revision of bylaws and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on it, but we're looking at theirs. Is there any kind of standard thing that you would advise that we need to include?
The Liberty Institute put out a sample facilities use policy. I think it matches mine, or mine is a little more improved from what they sent around. I don't mean to brag, but I put in more protections. But there are some resources. ACSI is the Association for Christian Schools International. They also sent around the same information, which are provisions you can put in concerning no activities outside the doctrine or the statement of faith.
Do you have that? Do you have a copy of that that you sent to us?
The one I'm sending you, the ACSI conflict or lifestyle statement, and I will send to you the facilities use policy and the facility use agreement that we are using. Yes. And it's basically a modification of Liberty Institutes.
There's another organization out there too, and they've changed their name recently. It's another 3 or 4 letter. What's conservative?
ACLJ or?
Yeah, the legal. I forget. One of them.
American Center for Law and Justice.
Religious freedom? To religious freedom?
Oh, there's Christian Legal Society.
Alliance Defending Freedom Group. Yeah. The idea. They've got a bunch of PDF policy samples that you can download. Doctrinal statements. They've got a whole bunch of kind of stuff. We review a lot of that. Going into great hours.
And do we need to run it by a lawyer in our state? You advise that?
I would advise that if you can, yeah. Especially if it's in a contract. Always have a lawyer review the contracts that you use.
Not all lawyers are created equal.
That's true. And employment law is a specialty. If you have employees and you have employment contracts, have an employment lawyer look them over. I've got a guy in a lawsuit right now because some guy claimed he could look over the contracts and he missed a whole bunch of stuff.
Is it, would it be advisable to have, say you're covered by church mutual, would it be advisable to let them see a copy of that?
I'll tell you that my experience with Brotherhood Mutual is fantastic. I don't know church mutual as well, but Brotherhood Mutual wants to see all your policies, your contracts, they'll give you feedback.
Yeah.
They bend over backwards, they pray for their insureds.
So if there's an issue, you know, ultimately it's your liability coverage with your insurance company. It's their lawyers who are going to be arguing for it.
That's right. They're appointed lawyers.
Right. So it's not a bad idea to run it for them.
A little preview of tomorrow, too. I don't know if you'll all attend tomorrow on discrimination and harassment, but I want to let you know that if you have job descriptions in place that will make your employees ministerial, if they can be truly ministerial, they'll be exempt from the discrimination laws. to a larger extent. So, for example, if you have a Christian school in your church, and you have certain people who are teachers of the doctrine, actually facilitate the message, you have maybe just teaching aides or assistants who come in and monitor the kids on the playground and go away, you have secretaries, janitors, that kind of thing, you need to develop job descriptions that will infuse in them the ways in which that person is a ministerial employee. Because non-ministerial employees, secretaries, front desk people, even if they're sharing the gospel, even if they're nice Christian people, can later come back and sue you for discrimination. Or you could terminate them for some kind of a category, let's say disability. There's some cases that I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And they can sue and get damages. I have one Christian school that I've represented for years. Every employee signs a statement of faith. I promise I'm a Christian. I'm going to have this particular lifestyle that matches the Bible. A couple years later, this woman came to the administrator and said, I need a place to pray to Mecca 3 times a day. They had to accommodate her, to give her religious accommodation to pray to Mecca because she was really Islamic and she was a teacher's aide. So they couldn't terminate her, clearly. She was just coming in to assist with the preschool. They didn't renew her contract the next year, but we had to handle it very carefully. So again, getting everyone to sign off on the statement of faith, getting it in your handbook, promising a certain lifestyle is critical. And I'll be talking more about that tomorrow. Yes, Phil?
I'm just thinking, from my perspective, this sounds absolutely overwhelming. Because as a pastor, how would I possibly have time to give oversight to all of that? I mean, it would take me totally away from cult. I mean, what's your advice to folks like me or to average churches where they just have pastors who want to teach the word and be nice to people?
My advice is do the best you can. Even if you take little pieces of this, even if you make sure you know where your articles and bylaws are and that they have some protections, you've got a statement of faith, it's passed out, you know, the mission, the religious purpose of the organization is publicized, you know, you're part of the way there. I understand you're not a contract drafter. You know, there might be ways you can get in contact.
We do fortunately have people like Brianna and others who are very good at this, but if the pastor doesn't have that, they almost have to hire someone like you, don't they, to keep...
Right, or Church Mutual, Brotherhood Mutual. Some insurance companies will help with that. I have found even the payroll companies, the paychecks and ADP and all those, will offer handbooks, right, and HR support, and they have no idea what they're doing with religious exempt employers. They're going to get you a generic handbook that talks about transsexual and no discrimination based upon same-sex anything. And so, yes, it's difficult. I would say take it a little bite at a time and do the best you can.
I have an elder who was a principal and worked for the school district. He has no problem. You know, so when we had to get permit for the sign, we fought with Riverside County on that. You could delegate some of this.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah.
Right, people with a gift of administration. When we were fighting with the utility company, we had a realtor who happened to be attending our church who came in, talked about property values. Builder.
Yeah.
Right? So talked about property values and how the construction would have to be handled. So enlist some friends. But that's not your calling. And it's not your calling to do all this paperwork. And I don't mean to be overwhelming. I do want to give you all the possibilities. Lawyers are in the business of providing worst case scenarios. Right? So at least you have some warning.
Like you said, you're a fairly small church. You've got that crank call.
Exactly.
And you could do that.
Right. Even if you talk to your people, even if you have meetings, hey, let's talk about what our answer is to someone who's calling or inquiring on the streets. I had a gay friend ask me if Stephen would do his wedding. You got to be ready to give a defense for our faith, right? And that position paper should be in place to back you up.
And we added to ours that all ceremonies provided by staff and employees shall be in keeping with the church's policies. So it gives me cover. If I say no and someone gets their nose out of me,
That's great. In fact, I will say that in California, you can get a one-day license no matter who you are to perform a wedding ceremony. Really? You do not have to be a pastor.
Right.
You don't have to be a... So our gay buddy got a one-day license to marry another friend of mine. And that's, you know, any of your parishioners could do that.
Yeah. So you want to cover not just you, but the use of your facilities.
Right.
You let other pastors who's, you know, we have a lot of churches that don't have facilities. You know, new churches are meeting in schools and stuff. And we'd be happy to let them use our sanctuary. But it's still to follow the facilities usage agreement.
Right.
You know.
Our facility use agreement says that any uses will comply and meet the standards of our policies and positions. So we covered that. But we also put staff employees serving other functions shall also be compliant with the church policies.
One more note to Phil, too. An easy thing to do is educate your people about what to say if the media asks questions. Be prepared. If it's everybody has to go to Phil Nordman with all of our questions about media. All inquiries have to go to the lead pastor, or this particular elder or the lead pastor. There's a designated person so that no one tries to talk for the church.
And a lot of places have that. I mean, the entire department. And
yeah.
Our public, we're all under orders. It's part of orientation. You do not talk to the media. Somebody walks up to you with a call, says, "What's going on?" You don't know. Your job is to control traffic there. That's all you say. You know, send them to a chief.
Yeah.
And
right.
The white helmets are the only people that talk with the media.
Right.
Same with the Navy, only the PA.
We got a question in the back. I want to address.
No, I have a close friend who's absolutely involved in the Gordon College situation. He said regarding the transsexuality issues and gender issues is that it's a moving target. There's some question as to no matter how well you write up things, whether it's going to make any difference or not in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a cultural orthodoxy being put in place by our government, so it's a new way that we respond to government today. It's faulted. It's just that's alarming for me.
Right, and I'll tell you that tomorrow I have federal cases that protect religious institutions from all those issues. Designate somebody as ministerial, you're protected from all discrimination laws, you're exempt as an employer, and that within the last 2 months there have been cases in Ohio and California that have said, forget that, we're diving right into the religious institutions, we're not going to allow them to discriminate, they must educate on these things, and they can't make employment decisions based upon lifestyle, a lesbian woman having a baby by artificial insemination, any of that. We're being invaded.
75% of Christians don't vote.
Mm-hmm.
Our fault.
That's right.
Yeah.
Totally our fault. Then we're dealing with a lot of questions.
All right, the e-handout sign up somewhere around the clipboard. Feel free to sign that up, sign up for that. I can't answer all your questions if you start emailing me with questions about your particular ministry, but I can redirect you to an attorney near you.
Well, if you want to answer them, it's $400 an hour.
What part of that?
That's not my nonprofit rate, by the way, which is much lower than that.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Sure. Any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'll take your license and form, please, as you go.